You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll hear from a neighborhood pharmacist who's been serving loyal Milwaukee customers for decades.
First, a federal judge has now approved Wisconsin's plan for additional voter ID education leading up to Election Day in a couple weeks. Earlier this month, federal judge James Peterson ordered the state to increase education efforts for the voter ID law, especially for a petition process for those who can't easily get a state-issued voting ID.
Laurel White joins us from our Capitol Bureau now for more on this story. She's the state Capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. Laurel, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So here we are less than 2 weeks before the general election, and there is a new iteration of a voter ID education plan. What's the latest, Laurel?
Yeah, so the voter ID saga continues to evolve in Wisconsin. The latest thing that happened was just yesterday. The federal judge, James Peterson, approved this new outreach plan. So the expanded education plan was part of his ruling that he handed down, saying that the state needed to reach out to voters, particularly voters who might be eligible for a petition process because they can't get a state-issued ID. They don't have the correct documents to get that right away. So he told the plaintiffs in the suit, which is One Wisconsin Institute is the lead plaintiff. They're a liberal advocacy organization, to work with the state and come up with this new outreach plan. And that was released on Friday. And we got a little bit of feedback on that. And he approved it just yesterday.
And what's in the plan?
So there are kind of two parts of the plan. I think the best way to describe it would be that the first part is what both parties agree on. So the plaintiffs, that liberal group, and the state both agree that there should be updated informational handouts for people about this petition process, and those will be distributed at DMVs and municipal clerk's offices all over the state. And they also agreed to additional training for DMV workers, those are the people that issue those IDs, and additional quality assurance checks at DMVs across the state to make sure that the workers are providing accurate information, following the law. Basically, these accuracy checks are being referred to as secret shoppers. So folks just kind of coming in and presenting scenarios. So that's what everybody agrees on. That's the first part. The second part is a little bit more complicated. It's where the state and the plaintiffs in the lawsuit don't agree. What the plaintiffs were asking for that the state says it can't pull off. And that's pretty wide-ranging, but the highlights include mobile DMVs to travel around the state, educational billboards outside of Milwaukee, and direct outreach to people who had been denied after entering this petition process previously.
So that latter part, it sounds like the state says, no, we're not going to be able to pull that together. So does that mean just the first part of the plan that you mentioned, that's what's going forward?
Well, that would be a little bit too easy, I think. So voter ID continues to be very complicated in Wisconsin in these court challenges and the iterations. So what's happening is that everything that was agreed upon is in effect right now. That went into effect immediately after Judge Peterson's order yesterday. And then he said, okay, well, let's look at all of these other things that you didn't agree on. I'm going to evaluate those, and I'm going to issue another ruling in a few days.
Oh, boy.
As to what to do about those things. So those things were the billboards, the direct outreach, and the mobile DMVs.
Okay, so the saga continues, so we may mm-hmm. see yet another form of this new voter education campaign. And as we said, there's not a lot of time before Election Day. What is the thinking about how thoroughly any of this can be implemented before Election Day with so little time to go?
Right. That's really the primary argument of the state, is that there just isn't very much time to implement any new outreach. They said that it's not technologically feasible to get those mobile DMVs up and running, because a mobile DMV, something that would travel and help people get IDs, would need Wi-Fi, would need certain software and systems that they're not sure they can accomplish really in 2 weeks. And they said that the billboards would also be hard to acquire in that amount of time. So as you know, we've only got 2 weeks until the election. So it sort of depends on what Judge Peterson says, if he really enforces and says the state needs to try to accomplish those things in 2 weeks, or if he accepts that argument.
So we'll stand by to hear how that that process is going. We're talking right now with Laurel White, state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio, joining us to talk about latest news that a federal judge has approved Wisconsin's voter ID education plan, but the exact format of that plan is still to be determined. And Laurel, early voting has begun around the state. What have we seen so far?
So early voting kicked off in some communities in Wisconsin as long as a month ago. So Madison and Milwaukee kicked off their early voting on September 26th. A few communities around the state started even before that. And actually, interestingly, early voting is a result of this same court case that we were just talking about that's relevant to the voter education campaign. When the original ruling came down in that case in July, the judge said the restrictions that have been passed on early voting in Wisconsin are not constitutional. They need to be struck down. So that opened up a whole new world of early voting in Wisconsin, more hours, more locations. And that's been going on, as I said, for about a month. We had some interesting news today about early voting in Green Bay. An open records request revealed that the Green Bay City Clerk was concerned about having an early voting site on the UW Green Bay campus.
Right, that's been a big story today. Right. What happened?
Well, basically what she did, she reached out to the State Elections Commission seeking advice in August, saying, I know there's a state law that says you can't have a polling place that benefits one party more than the other. I think it's possible. I believe I've heard that students tend to vote for Democratic candidates. What about having this early voting location on the UW Green Bay campus? Could I use the argument that that would benefit Democrats? So we got that email via an open records request, as I mentioned, and the State Elections Commission responded and said, you know, we don't think that that really is a argument that we would advise you to make. Other things that she brought up, she was concerned about having enough staff to cover the early voting site. And they said that's a very legitimate concern. Other clerks have raised that kind of concern, but they kind of turned her away from the partisan argument of saying that it could benefit Democrats.
And so what happens next? Will there be any further fallout from this email release?
Well, it's really nothing, as far as I know, can really happen with the case at this point. I think that this is just being used as, I think advocates would say, maybe proof that there are some partisan inclinations in limiting early voting, because it does tend to be Democrats that participate in early voting more strongly. We've seen those numbers come back from the State Elections Commission affirming that early voting has been very strong in Dane County and Milwaukee County. So I think that this just kind of adds fuel to the fire maybe for that argument, but I wouldn't imagine that we're going to have any additional kind of legal ramifications of this story today.
And what about that site in question? Did it come to pass, or was it not something that was going to be going forward?
That is not going to happen. There is not going to be an early voting site on the UW Green Bay campus. There is actually only one early voting location in Green Bay, and that is at the city clerk's office.
And looking now, Laurel, at early voting as a whole, maybe as an indication of what kind of turnout we could see in Wisconsin, what do we know about what sorts of numbers are out there?
Well, it seems to be pretty strong so far. As I mentioned before, we've had more early voting this year than we've had in recent years. More hours are available because of that court decision. And we got some numbers from Madison today, actually, that show that they are almost at the level of 2012. And we've still, of course, got 2 weeks to go. So I think it's a pretty safe bet to say that we are going to see unprecedented early voting numbers in Wisconsin.
And in terms of how the voter ID law affects turnout and affects turnout in specific areas of the state, what do you think we have to wait for until we can start to draw some conclusions about the effects of early voting, of the voter ID law, rather, in Wisconsin?
Well, we'll just have to wait and see until after the election. I mean, there are these new early voting opportunities available in certain communities, but those do tend to be communities that are more Democratic leaning. So we're seeing these early voting numbers coming back in. They seem to be supporting Democrats. But many Republican communities don't have those opportunities available yet, and that is a part of the voter ID kind of package of laws. So I think we're going to have a lot to look at after the election is over, to look at the impacts of this voter ID law.
Laurel, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yes, thanks for having me.
That was Laurel White, State Capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio, and she joined us there to talk about the news that a federal judge has approved Wisconsin's voter ID education plan, although the exact form that plan takes is still a little up in the air.
Dr. Lester Carter Jr. has been serving his community since the late 1960s when he purchased a neighborhood pharmacy in Milwaukee.
In his neighborhood, he's known simply as Dr. Carter, and Rob Ferret recently spoke with him about his longstanding commitment to his loyal customers over the years.
You are not from Wisconsin originally. How did you end up becoming a pharmacist in Milwaukee?
I'm originally from Omaha, Nebraska. After graduation from high school in 1949, I enlisted in the U.S. Navy during the Korean War. I spent 4 years in the Navy, 2.5 years on the USS Tortuga in charge of the sick bay. Mm-hmm. And in between time, when we weren't involved in carrying in invasion forces, our job was to clean up the mines. And boy, that was a hideous job. Taking them back to Yokohama, where the Army base there would detonate them. So after all of that transpired and I got out, and then I decided, well, heck, I've been involved in the medical end of the work all the time I was in the Navy. I think I'll go to pharmacy school. And boy, did I never dream how tough it was. Holy mackerel. 18 hours in organic chemistry, organic physics. I'm going to go nuts. Well, fortunately, there was a fellow that lived across the street from me, was kind enough to help tutor me. And then after that, I said, boy, I think I can make it. And there was a close family friend who was about two classes ahead of me, had moved to Milwaukee and taken over a little drugstore on 7th and Walnut. And when he'd want some time off, he would ask me to come up for the weekend. And after, two or three years, one Saturday night, the store burned down to the ground. So then he moved over on 8th and North at Sanger's, and then he started contacting me. We need some help. Come on up. And I said, well, wait a minute. I did my internship at a Rexall store. In those days, I would say a good 70% of the prescriptions had to be made from scratch and compounded. Suppositories, creams, and elixirs, and all of that all had to be made from scratch. Wow. And with me available, well, now let's let Carter handle all of that.
Oh, no.
And we won't have to do it. After about a year of being asked to come here, I finally decided, oh, heck, maybe I'll go up there and give it a shot.
Well, I've
never left Omaha.
I understand you're working in a mainly German-American neighborhood. You're an African-American pharmacist. What happened?
When I came here, I worked at the little store with John for about 6 months, and I said, I want to get my own store. Get your own store. You don't know nobody. You won't. I said, well, let me give it a shot. So I talked to the manager of McKesson's here, and he says, I got the perfect store for you, Carter, over on 24th and Burleigh. So we got together. The whole sale was handled with a handshake. Now, can you imagine that in today's world? Now, the only fly in the ointment was the neighborhood at that time was about 70% German. Okay. Here I'm a black pharmacist from Nebraska. And when the patrons start coming in, well, my goodness, that guy back there is black. Does he know what he's doing? And the owner that I bought it from, the previous owner, was a German speaking German.
Mm-hmm.
So he says, "Okay, Carter, we gotta do something here, so these people have some confidence in you." I said, "Well, what do? Stand on my head?" He said, "Just do exactly like I tell you." I said, "Okay." He said, "When the ladies come in the morning and looking around, German ladies, he says, you look them directly in the eye and stand straight and tall and say, 'Wie geht's, mein Frau?'" I said, "Well, yeah, okay, what does that mean?" He said, "That means good morning, ma'am." I said, "Well, how about when the fellows come in?" He said, "You do the same thing, look them in the eye and say, 'Wie geht's, mein Herr?'" He said, "That means good morning, sir." I said, "Well, what have I got to lose? I'll give it a shot." So the next morning, I said that to the ladies and then to the men. And they all said, "You know, that guy can't be all bad if he speaks German." And from then on, it was nothing but love.
Did you end up learning more German than just hello, ma'am, hello, sir?
Oh, a few words.
A few words here and there.
But they were convinced that I was all right. If I could greet them that way, that pretty much convinced them that I can't be all bad.
That's great. Well, I understand that you're not, you know, not just a druggist. You're not just a guy who fills that prescription. You try to help people out with their whole health, preventive, some alternative,
Absolutely.
Things like that.
Absolutely. My thought was that so often ladies would come in and say, "You know, it's time for school to start, and little Junior here has got this ringworm in the scalp, and we've used all types of medications that we got from the dermatologist, and internal as well as topical preparations, and nothing has worked. And he can't get back into school because the school nurse says it's contagious stage and consequently won't let him back in. And that means I got to stay home, I have to work," and on and on and on it went. So Carter goes to his chemistry books and does some review and studying about how to put together an antifungal agent that once and for all would be safe enough to use with young people and yet be effective enough to clear this stubborn problem up. And that was one of the first preparations that I formulated, which, by the way, now includes about 12 different combinations. And once they started using this and the word got around, "You know, I use that antifungal cream that I got down at Carter's down there, and in 10 days it was cleared up. Never seen nothing like it." So then, of course, now I get requests for all over the state and every place else. And to this day, 30-some years later, practically 40-some years later, I would say, nothing has come along from the big pharmaceutical companies that's been more beneficial than any of the 12 different preparations that I formulated. One for the scalp ringworm, one for psoriasis and eczema and shingles and razor bumps and keloids and on and on and on.
What part of running your neighborhood pharmacy brings you the most joy?
When people come back, like now, I still work about 4 days a week, and they come back and say, "I'm the third generation, fourth generation. You took care of my grandmother, and you did this. And when I had this, that, and the other, and was a baby, you cleared it up. Now here's my grandchildren with this problem." That's what brings satisfaction.
And you're still going, like you say, generations in.
I'm still working. I go in my old store Monday, Thursday, and Saturday, and the the new owners, Hyatt, they have about 10 or 11 stores. I go in one of their stores on Friday and help them out there and give them advice and different things. So it keeps me busy, keeps me out there. And that's the only, from my standpoint, as long as you can do this kind of work comfortably and not be in pain or whatever, then I want to be working. And I think that contributes to a longer, more productive life as long as you keep working.
Dr. Carter, thank you for your service back during the Korean War. Thanks for your service to your community.
Well, thank you. And I have expressed this feeling at, I don't know, numerous different talks at universities and middle schools and around the country, that from my standpoint, irregardless of the problems and that we have here, this is still the greatest country on this planet. And if I had to do it over again, I would enlist just like I did during the Korean War, because I feel that everything I was able to accomplish in life, what little that may be, is all due to having the supreme privilege of coming up in America.
Thank you so much for spending this time with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Dr. Lester Carter Jr. is a pharmacy owner serving the Milwaukee community for the past 59 years. He spoke with Central Times' Rob Ferret. In the late stages of a presidential race, candidates want voters to see them alongside the big names of American presidential history. Depending on their ideology and their party, they might compare themselves to Washington, Lincoln, Reagan, or maybe one or both Roosevelts.
But one name that doesn't get dropped very often on the campaign trail, James Buchanan, 15th President of the United States. Elected as president in 1856, Buchanan served one term in office, and by the end of that term, states were seceding from the Union, kicking off the American Civil War.
Our next guest says James Buchanan wasn't just a bad president. He says there's a strong case to be made that Buchanan was the absolute worst president in American history.
Robert Strauss joins us now. His new book is Worst President Ever, James Buchanan, the POTUS Rating Game, and the Legacy of the Least of the Lesser Presidents. Robert, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, thank you.
So this worst president ever, a very low bar there, how do you sort through the nuances of history to draw a firm conclusion for who could be the worst president ever?
Well, of course, I'll argue with anybody, and then they can always have their opinions. But when I pitched the book to my agent, who happens to be Obama's agent, so that's sort of interesting itself. But I said, well, you know, half of America thinks Barack Obama was the worst president. The other half thinks George Bush is the worst president. But neither of them started the Civil War.
All right. So there's something right there. So, I mean, are there objective criterion that you could look at about what makes a president a really bad one?
Well, you know, I give my case for Buchanan over a long term of his 4 years. I would say that when you look at these ratings, there have been many historical ratings by, you know, compiling historians and journalists and talking about it. But what I would say is you have to sort of rate them by what happens during their term and what the legacy is after their term. So Buchanan had a series of bad decisions. He was the most he had the longest resume of anybody who's ever run for president. He was a state legislator in Pennsylvania. He was a U.S. congressman, U.S. senator, ambassador to Russia, ambassador to England, and secretary of state. So that's about 30, 40 years of what people would call good public service. But and that's the big but. As the president, he really messed up.
Yeah, and you go into detail about him messing up as president. One place I read, you said he just couldn't make a decision. He was always waffling. Was that the downfall? Tell me a little bit about his inability to make a decision.
Right. Well, that's the overall thought. If you take all the people we think of as great presidents, Washington, Lincoln, FDR, they were all decisive guys. Buchanan spent all this time in his government service being conciliatory. He was an ambassador. Well, just think what ambassadors do. He never proposed any significant legislation. As Secretary of State, he was a waffler. President Polk, for whom he served, always looked at him and said, you know, what do you really want me to do? And he would go back and forth on every decision. But his legacy starts when he becomes president. When he gets elected in 1856, which is an odd election, begin with three parties, two of them which never existed before, the Republicans and the Know-Nothings. The Democrats were established, so they won with Buchanan, even though he was 65 years old, which was awfully old at the time. He looks around for a legacy, and his legacy is he's going to settle the slavery problem. So he sees this court case wandering around, the Dred Scott case. A slave that had gone to Minnesota with his military master for a while, so he was living in a free state, comes back to Missouri, master dies, he sues in court to become a free man. Buchanan goes behind the scenes, works with the Supreme Court Chief Justice Roger Taney, who went to Dickinson College, though not at the same time as Buchanan, where he also went to Dickinson. It's a small school in Pennsylvania. He decides to get another northern judge to go along with whatever Taney decides. The Supreme Court is five southerners and four northerners. And he finds another man named Robert Story, who also went to Dickinson. They decide that there's now a majority that includes northerners in the case. So Taney comes out with this decision. He says Dred Scott can't sue. He's not a citizen. In fact, we can't even outlaw slavery in the North. The Constitution doesn't allow it. So Buchanan has influenced this decision. It becomes a disaster because the 20-year expansion of the government, the economy, has been going on, stops on a dime. People don't know exactly what to do. Let's say you have a tin cup factory in Wisconsin somewhere. You decide, well, you know, I'm doing pretty well. Maybe I'll go down to Illinois, open up my second tin cup factory. And say, well, wait a second. So somebody can come up from Kentucky with slaves. So commerce stops. There's a precipitous decline in the economy. It's called the Panic of 1857. Railroads go bankrupt. Other businesses go bankrupt in concert with them. Every bank in New York closes for a day, at least a day, because they won't take scrip. They won't take bills. They'll only take gold or silver. The North, which is dependent on manufacturing expansion, dries up. And Buchanan says, well, you guys speculated. You deserve it. You should have been like the people in the South, which had, you know, worked hard on the land with agriculture, were able to feed and clothe their people, and in that exacerbates the split between North and South.
We're talking with Robert Strauss right now, author of the new book, Worst President Ever, James Buchanan, the POTUS Rating Game, and the Legacy of the Least of the Lesser Presidents. And Robert, what you're describing there is, it sounds like someone who has sympathies with the South, and he also is trying to please the North, and it sounds like he kind of ends up in the middle, but pleasing no one. So what did he do when it came, do or not do, I guess, when it came to the Civil War and the possible dissolution of the Union?
Right. So at some point, he won't support the next candidate. He decided he's going to be a one-term president, and the next guy in line was Stephen Douglas, and he really didn't support him. And he put the convention in the South, where in Charleston, where nobody was going to nominate a Northern Democrat. Douglas was from Illinois. So the Democratic Party splits into three, thus assuring Lincoln's election and then certainly assuring that the states would start to secede. And he says, well, the Constitution says they can't secede, but it never says anything that I can't do anything about it. So seven states secede under his watch in that short time between Lincoln's election and his inauguration. So Buchanan does nothing to stop it. Of course, now we have seven states that have started to form the Confederacy. The war is sort of inevitable at that point.
But to be fair, this is the eve of the Civil War. The nation is incredibly divided over the issue of slavery. Could anyone have been effective or succeeded in a situation like this? Is he getting a bad rap?
Well, no, he's not getting a bad rap because we do have an example, and that's Andrew Jackson. South Carolina had moved to nullify a law under Jackson. He says, no, you can't do it. And they say, well, then we're going to secede. And he says, no, you're not. And they don't. He uses the force of the office to keep the Union together. And succeeding presidents, while there's no question there's divisiveness and slavery being the big number, but the next six or seven presidents, the country doesn't break up under them. They don't interpret things that way. So yes, he could have stopped it.
We're talking about low points in American leadership with Robert Strauss, author of the new book, Worst President Ever, James Buchanan, the POTUS Rating Game, and the Legacy of the Least of the Lesser Presidents.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Who do you rank as the best or worst president in American history from the beginning of the nation through the 20th century? And how should we rank presidents? What factors should we throw into that mix? And what do you think of if you think of James Buchanan? What comes to mind there? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're continuing our conversation with Robert Strauss, author of the book Worst President Ever. He tells the story of President James Buchanan in the era leading up to the Civil War and tries to figure out what we can learn about what makes a bad president.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Who do you think is the worst president ever? And we can leave the most recent presidents maybe off that list so history has a little bit more time to settle down and give us an indication of what that legacy might be. Or do you have a question about James Buchanan or how we rank the best and the worst presidents? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And let's take a caller now, Camus from Madison. Hi, Camus.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What would you like to say about the worst president ever?
Well, I mean, I think that's a judgment call. But one thing, my two cents on this matter is that I think William H. Taft was a pretty bad president simply because he did not keep his word to Teddy Roosevelt. And Teddy Roosevelt was the one who pretty much established and set forth like a legacy of conservation agendas. And that was going to be hard to live up to anyways. But, he was handpicked by Teddy Roosevelt. And he didn't continue that at all.
And so what would you say, Robert, about other contenders for the worst president ever and Taft?
Well, Taft's sort of in the middle there. He's not completely ineffectual. And of course, Roosevelt sort of he ran against him the next time and sort of messed up his chances. But I would say that people sort of generally pick the same group of guys, so far they're only guys, as the worst. Franklin Pierce, Buchanan's predecessor, certainly ranks in there. He sort of led the way towards Buchanan, but of course the Civil War didn't start on his watch. A lot of people among modern presidents sort of pick Richard Nixon and Jimmy Carter. I would say Jimmy Carter's post-presidency makes him much more valuable. But he also despite not doing so well in Iran, he did broker the only real Middle East peace settlement between Egypt and Israel. He brought consciousness to environmental issues. It depends on Nixon whether you think resigning in disgrace is worse than starting the Civil War, but Nixon also opened China to trade. He started the Environmental Protection Agency. He had other positive things during his presidency.
And looking back at Buchanan there, I'm curious, was his reputation as an ex-president already in the gutter, even in his own lifetime? Or is this one where we look back and go, oh, that didn't go well, and he was a terrible president?
Well, here's the thing. He did come home to Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and had a little glory as he came home. But soon after, as the war gets started, even early in the war, people come by his house and throw vegetables at it. They write graffiti on the gates. He's scared that when the war comes to Gettysburg, which is not far from his house, that he'll be captured, and who knows what would happen to him. He did support Lincoln throughout the war, so he's conciliatory, but then he writes his memoirs, the first real memoirs of a president, and blames the North for starting the Civil War. So that didn't go over very well.
Yeah,
and he died not in disgrace, but not, you know, not as a hero.
And I want that's leading into what I wanted to ask you about. With this memoir that he wrote, how did he portray his term as president? Did he know that it went that poorly as it did?
Well, he knew that he didn't. He was a little despondent towards the end of his presidency. John Tyler, the ex-president, views him walking around the White House in sort of a depression towards the end of his term. So he knew things didn't go particularly well, but he doesn't take even afterwards. He doesn't really take responsibility for the worst thing that happened, which of course is the Civil War.
I'm curious, as we, you know, look toward the future and a new president, are there lessons that we can learn today to avoid the fate of James Buchanan? I mean, specifically looking at indecisiveness. Is that one of the fatal flaws a president can have?
That's what I would say. I would say, look, I mean, president comes in, who should he or she look to? Well, you know, you can't sort of replicate Washington and Lincoln's term. You can't start the country over again, and it's unlikely we're going to go into civil war, despite what some people might think. So who do you look at? Do you look at James Monroe, you know, like pretty good president? I mean, that's like saying you want to be the second best hitter on your baseball team. So what you can do is look at a failed presidency and say, I don't want to do that. And if you're going to be serious, I can be humorous about it, but if you want to be serious about it, it's being decisive. That's what you're going to make mistakes, but you got to make a decision. You're the top person now. It's not, you're not the ambassador, you're not the secretary of state, you're not even a senator. You're the top person. And as you know, the cliche about Truman, the buck stops here, and that's what you have to do, I think, to be a good president.
Robert, thank you so much for joining us.
I'm glad to have been there.
That was Robert Strauss, and we've been talking about his new book. It's called Worst President Ever, James Buchanan, The POTUS Rating Game, and the Legacy of the Least of the Lesser Presidents.